Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, we look at Sansa's first chapter in A Clash of Kings, and my guest is Professor Jan Doolittle Wilson. Also, if you've been watching Andor, or if you're planning on watching Andor, I will be joining the Lorehounds for their season wrap of that show. So do a search for Lorehounds if you're interested in that. But today's order of business is Sansa, and specifically our first look at Joffrey's notion of kingship. Cameos in this chapter include the Hound and Tyrion, and we get our first introduction to Dontos. And then I include a bit of my conversation with historian Professor Ian McInnes. If you're interested in looking at a window into the medieval world, have a look at his book, Scotland's Second War of Independence. Ian and I talk a little bit about House of the Dragon and historical parallels. All right, without further ado, here is Professor Jan Doolittle Wilson. Jan Doolittle Jan. I'll try that again. Jan Doolittle Wilson, welcome back to Electric Boogaloo. I hear that you have a new publication in the world, and yes, I wanted to ask you about it.
I do. And hi, Anthony. Thank you again for inviting me back. I do. This is a collection of critical essays that are focused on the HBO series, A Game of Thrones, although there are many references to the books as well. It's from McFarland Press, and it's titled Power and Subversion in Game of Thrones, edited by A. Keith Kelly. And so it's a collection of essays written by academics, both in the United States and different places in Europe. So it's a really good collection of scholars
and
coming
what
from.
What is the title of your essay, if you remember? Yeah, I know that you wrote this a long time ago.
I did. I'm looking it up right now.
Sometimes.
So it's... mine is titled, Who Has a Better Story Than Bran the Broken? The Power of Disability Narratives.
Nice.
And so there, you know, I think my essay is maybe the only one on disability, but there's gender theory.
Okay.
So looking at, you know, the female characters, looking at ideas of, you know, how is masculinity portrayed? How is it kind of complicated throughout the series? Tons of stuff on medieval history, you know, drawing comparisons and how medievalism is,
yes,
you know, portrayed within the series. So a lot of really... I can't wait to sit down and read through all of the various essays because I've only read mine at this point. So
okay. Well, all right. I'm sure that a number of our listeners will want to pick that up. And one thing that I like about McFarlane is that they don't often put out like $300 books.
Yes.
some presses will do that for academic works.
Very true.
Now, I've asked you to help me look at Sansa Stark.
Yes.
And this chapter, we could go a number of directions, you know, directions specifically that make me think of you and your work. We could talk about Tyrion and perceptions of disability. We could talk about the ways that gender is on display in this chapter. But I want to begin, and I don't know how you're going to respond to this, but I want to begin with a question that I asked my previous guest, Stephanie.
Okay.
And it very well could be that you don't have a good answer for this, but in both Arya's chapter and Sansa's chapter, they are beaten, or at least there's a reference to them being beaten.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of these times where it's like, you know, isn't the medieval period so different than ours? But in addition to that, it's like, I'm old enough to remember being beaten, you know, not as severely as Sansa or Arya, but that was part of my childhood. I think it might be something that now I'm sort of on the lower end of Gen X.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting cusp, I think. Like, I think we are both are born around the cusp of when it was sort of like typical to spank children in America.
Right.
And then it's kind of hit or miss, you know, in the generation below us or after us.
I agree. Yeah. it wouldn't raise that many eyebrows, right? In the time that we were, you know, growing up.
Right,
And that was
right.
just, I don't have statistics to bear this out, but I would think it was pretty typical. And certainly not the kind of, you know, controversy subject for debate, you know, that it is today for sure.
Right. At least it would raise eyebrows. Like,
right.
You know, there may be different philosophies out there, but, you know, the culturally, it's not just part of the typical American childhood as it once was.
Right.
Now, of course, I can't speak to other parts of the world or whatever, but this is one of those situations where it's like Sansa refers to herself being beaten. You know, not by a parent, you know, by like the parent of the realm, I suppose, for reasons that are absolutely ridiculous.
Right.
But I wonder if we look at that differently and with modern eyes. I wonder if it's just like, well, sometimes children were beaten and that's just part of life.
Yeah, you know, I think in Sansa's case, it's for me, it's not even so much the idea of, you know, well, this is how you discipline a child. It's probably more just how pervasive it was to beat women in general.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So the idea that if your wife, the person that you are, you know, intimately connected to, gets out of line, then that's how you handle it. You know, you assert that kind of patriarchal
right.
control. And, you know, the first time it happens to Sansa, it's in the earlier chapters, you know, toward the end of Game of Thrones, where, you know, it's the first time the Night comes in and
right.
on Joffrey's command, slaps her, you know, hits her in the face.
Right.
And she is so shocked by that, I think, because that kind of violence was not a part of her upbringing. It was not a part of her childhood. At least not directed toward the Stark children. You know, certainly she grows up in an extremely violent world, but not, you know, as a kind of a disciplinary mechanism. And then I think the other shocking thing for her is that you're a knight. You're supposed to be chivalrous.
Mm, yeah.
This is not how you treat a lady. I am a lady. And certainly this command is not supposed to be coming from my valiant prince.
Right.
So I think there, you know, there's a lot going on there. It's a really
harsh and of course,
awakening.
Yeah, of course we know that Joffrey's a budding abuser, right?
Yes.
So we don't know. I don't think we are aware of what he is absolutely capable of yet at this point in the story.
Right. She's learning, right?
Yes.
She's
learning a lot of things.
Yes.
Anyway, let me jump into the synopsis, and then we can talk a little bit more about whatever you want to talk about. All right, so
okay, I have notes. You know, I have notes.
Sansa reflects on the meaning of the comet, the political upheaval between North and South, and the bruises on her arms. Sir Aerys Okhart escorts her to the tournament for Joffrey's name day, and tells her that Tywin has retained his army at Harrenhal rather than coming to King's Landing. After a few rounds, a drunken knight named Dontos arrives half-naked and fails even to mount his horse. Joffrey, angered by the display, orders for the man to be drowned in a cask of wine. Sansa objects and tricks Joffrey into making Dontos his fool.
You can't!
What did you say? Did you say I can't?
I only meant it would be bad luck to kill a man on your name day.
What kind of stupid peasant superstition?
The girl is right. When a man sows on his name day, he reaps all year.
Take him away. I'll have him killed tomorrow, the
when
fool.
Tommen gets a chance to ride against a straw man. That is when Tyrion arrives.
I just got a mental picture.
Yeah. That is when Tyrion arrives. Behind him is an odd assortment of sellswords and brutes. He greets Tommen and Marcella warmly, offers his condolences to Sansa, and calls Sander a cur. Joffrey asks him if he brought a gift. Tyrion says, yes, my wits. So, Jan Wilson, I've asked you to bring either an observation and or a question to the table. What did you bring to the table?
Well, let's maybe start with the observation. Mm-hmm. You know, she is so young. I think we forget, you know, especially in the books, just how young she is. She's 11 when the story starts. I think she's 12.
I think she's
at
12.
This point.
Yeah.
And she's a child. You know, she is a child. And yet, in rereading this, and again, you know, I'm so happy that I had the opportunity just to kind of sit down and look at Sansa, you know, just kind of on her own. I think she's a character who can blend in at times, which is kind of part of the point. We'll maybe come back to that. But just in kind of rereading her chapters, I am struck by how strong she is.
Yeah.
Just this kind of quiet strength and composure that is quite astonishing, you know, for someone her age. I was comparing, you know, here we have a tourney. You know, we have a tourney early on in Game of Thrones where we start kind of learning more about Sansa's character. And she's sitting at this first tourney, which of course is the tourney for the Hand, right?
Yeah.
When she first arrives at King's Landing. And she's sitting next to Jane Poole, her very good friend. And the first knight is killed at that earlier tourney. And Jane just falls apart, right? They have to kind of escort her away. She's hysterical. And Sansa at 11 years old isn't crying. She's not screaming. A man is bleeding out right in front of her.
Right.
And she's just kind of thinking, oh, that's sad. It's sad that songs will not be sung for him, right? She's so calm in that moment. And, you know, that line about how as Jane is being carried away, Sansa is made of sterner stuff. And I thought, what a neat foreshadowing. I know you've covered this chapter, you know, with in your podcast earlier, but that line about she's made of sterner stuff. And so if you think about what she's doing during this tourney, she has that same kind of strength, but she's displaying it now in different ways. And she knows what she's up against.
Yeah.
She knows how dangerous her situation is. And yet she, again, has composure. She's clear-headed. She's keeping her thoughts to herself. I love her internal dialogue. She's thinking to herself what she really feels and really wants to say. But what comes out of her mouth is extremely wise and diplomatic.
Until it's not. And then she kind of has to talk her way out of it, right?
And then she pulls back. You know, she's still, at moments, things will slip out.
Yeah.
But even that, she's able to pull back.
At one point,
Joffrey will give her a look.
Yeah.
And she thinks, oh, let me kind of sugarcoat this in a way where he won't know what I mean.
She's walking a really thin line.
Yes.
At one point, she says, a lady's armor is her courtesy.
Yes.
Right? And I think that she knows. She's learning to play the game, right? She's learning, like, these men, at least in public, have to act as if they are men of court, right? In the back rooms, they can do whatever they want. But in public, if I lean this way, they're going to have to lean that way.
Yes.
Because I know how to do this because I've read my stories and I know what courtesy is. You know, Septa Mordain taught me lessons about this, right?
Yes.
And so she's able, in public, she's able to handle herself pretty well. But from time to time, she will, it's almost you see a little bit of her inner world come to the surface.
Yes.
And there are a couple times in this chapter where she can't help herself. She's like, she could hear herself saying something. She knows she can't. She shouldn't say. Don't say it, right? But she can't stop herself from saying things. And she saves Dantos' life.
Yes.
Because there's something deeper. There's something more integral to her than just the courtesy, right?
Yes.
There's something about justice that bubbles up. Like, you can't. That's not fair.
He is a fool. You're so clever to see it. He'll make a much better fool than a knight. He doesn't deserve the mercy of a quick death.
Did you hear, my lady, Ser Dantos? From this day, you'll be my new fool.
Thank you, Your Grace. And you, my lady, thank you.
Anyway, I love this idea that a woman's armor or a lady's armor is her courtesy.
I kept thinking of that line too, Anthony, and it just shows again how clever the writing and the character development are. Because if you, again, go back to early Sansa, obviously very idealistic, very naive, as she should be. She's, again, a child. She's been raised in a world of privilege, right?
Yeah.
Everything that she does and says is validated, right? She embodies what a lady should be in this world. And so she's never had to deviate from that. And so all of those words, all of those lessons, you know, one of her greatest strengths is that she listens and she's absorbed all of those lessons, thinking that those lessons will be applied one way. And then when the world around her shifts so dramatically, she is just brilliantly, I think, able to take those lessons and apply them in a different situation.
Right.
And so the meaning of, you know, a lady's armor is her courtesy. That means something very different at the beginning of the first book than it will mean in this context.
Yeah, sure.
And I love that shift. You know, I love her ability to adapt those lessons to her current circumstances. Something that I don't think Ned ever really learned to do, by the way. I just kept comparing her to Ned as I went through this chapter, thinking she is amazing in her ability to take these ideas, this idea of virtue, you know, this idea of, you know, being a lady, being polite, and use that as a strength instead of using that to, you know, kind of further enable this world, you know, that that puts her in a certain position in a certain place. It becomes one of her greatest strengths.
And if you think about what armor is, it's like the hard exterior, right?
Yeah.
Whereas I think before she thought courtesy or courtly manners are something that you should hold deep down in your heart, right?
Yes.
That's something that's sort of core to my being, and all the other knights at court will be the same way, right? Because that's what defines a knight, is what's deep down in their heart. They're chivalrous and they're men of honor. She's learned that that's absolutely not true.
Yeah, in the worst way.
Right. So then what she's decided to do is, I'm going to weaponize.
Yes, I wrote that word down. Yes.
I'm going to weaponize courtesy to my benefit. And
yes,
it's sort of a different way to survive than Arya, who, you know, we just met in the previous chapter on the road. She sort of adopted a gendered disguise, right?
Yes.
And of course, because of that, Arya has to actually fight people. She has to actually physically fight them. And of course, Sansa is fighting in a different way. In a lot of ways, she's in more peril because there's no adult in the room that's on her side, at least not yet.
Right. She is so, that's the other thing that really struck me, how isolated she is. She doesn't have any of the kind of supports, right, that maybe some of the other characters have, who are also in great danger, but she is completely alone here. And that's the other kind of remarkable thing I think about Sansa, is she starts to learn not only how to play the game by being courteous, by not speaking, right? We tend to associate power and agency with action, with speaking, with being bold. And she really complicates and challenges, you know, our traditional ideas of what power is. And that word you used, weaponize, right? This was kind of a second big point for me. She really weaponizes that traditional femininity and uses it as strength, something that is supposed to keep her weak, right? Something that is supposed to keep her inferior. The idea is she's just a woman.
Uh-huh.
Well, fine. I will take that role and I will, again, use it as strength. I will use it as a way to survive. And this idea of flattery, you know, anytime Joffrey does or says something, she flatters him, but she does it in a way that she clearly knows how ridiculous he is. And he usually is kind of too stupid to pick up on that.
That's right.
She does that several times in this chapter and as, you know, the book goes on. But yeah, I just kept thinking about how there are so many different definitions of strength, and it's not always through a sword, right? That gets the most glory.
Sure.
I think in our tales, we love Arya, we love Brienne. We love those who, you know, pick up the sword and fight, but she's displaying a very different kind of strength that I don't think always gets the recognition and validation it should.
Yeah, I think that you could easily watch, if you were just like a show watcher, you might just move out of those first few seasons and think, well, poor Sansa. Or maybe you don't like her because, like, you know, she's horrible to Arya or whatever. I think after reading the first book and reading this first chapter, I think she's certainly smarter than Joffrey. And
oh, yes.
She's certainly learned some lessons. She's playing the game in a different way. I mean, I do feel sympathy for her for sure. But I think that she, you know, Tyrion shows up and says, you know, I'm bringing my wits with me. she has her wits about her.
Yes.
And I think you read that differently in the book than I think you read that on the, at least for the first few seasons of the show.
Right. No, I agree. You know, with the books, of course, we have insight into her internal monologue in ways that we don't get as overtly anyway in the show. And so I think there probably is a divide in terms of those who just watched the show and those who both watched the show and read the books, maybe in terms of how they feel about Sansa, because that was actually one of the questions I had for you, Anthony, is why do you think Sansa gets so much hate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm the right person to ask.
There's so much vitriol, you know, directed at this character.
I'm the right person to ask because I was a late adopter to Sansa.
Okay. Well, then let's start there then.
Yeah.
Why did you initially dislike her or...
Yeah.
Was it actual kind of vitriol or was it just more like she's not interesting?
I think it was because I think the books are teaching me to root for Arya.
Yeah.
Like I think in the last podcast I said something like Arya has to live under Sansa's shadow, and it's almost like when she gets out from under that shadow, the shadow's like a cocoon and now she can become a butterfly. But of course, that's from Arya's perception of these things.
Yeah.
And then even when I see things, even if I see the world from Sansa's perspective, it's like, how can you be so stupid not to see what Joffrey really is? Or how could you side with Joffrey over and against your own sister? You know, there are a few things early on in the first book that kind of teach you that this world of courtesy is like a facade.
Yeah.
And that Sansa's bought into the facade. But of course, Arya is living a more authentic life or something, or she's more true to herself or something like that.
Yeah.
It took me a while to actually come around to think, well, Sansa's doing everything she's been taught to do.
Yeah.
And she's still a child, even though that Arya evinces childhood in a different way. Sansa is every bit the child, and what should she have done differently given the situation?
Yeah.
I really had to kind of dive into sort of a deeper level and kind of leave the perception game beside, just, you know, put it to the side just a little bit to actually see the world from Sansa's perspective. I think that was sort of my initial aversion to Sansa.
No, I totally understand that. And that's one of the reasons I'm so glad that you know, George Martin decided to give Sansa point of view chapters in that first book, because I think it would be much worse if she didn't have, you know, point of view chapters. Then we would only be getting, you know, Arya's perspective.
Right.
And I think you're right. You know, especially in multiple reads, you kind of go back and think, really, what else could Sansa do when her entire upbringing, you know, was being kind of channeled into this idea that your role is this. This
yes.
is what a proper lady does. This is how you grow up and marry a prince, and that should be your ambition. And, you know, she is very much swept away by the stories, and it does take longer for her to, it really takes this horrible execution of her father in front of her very eyes.
Right.
You know, she says, I couldn't look away. Why couldn't I look away? I actually witnessed his head coming off of his body.
Right.
And that for her is, everything comes tumbling down right in that moment. And of course, again, you know, looking back as either book readers or show watchers, oh my goodness, child, why couldn't you see this sooner? Joffrey's
right.
horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, you know, she really has this very, again, closed off perspective of what life should be, because that's how she was raised. And, you know, I do feel sympathy for that. I think the other thing too, I'm the youngest of two older sisters. So there are three of us.
Mm.
And I also started thinking about just birth order when I was thinking about Sansa and Arya.
Sure, sure.
And certainly, yes, if you read through Arya chapters, it's, oh, Sansa's so perfect. And, mm-hmm. you know, Sansa this and Sansa that. But you can also see, I think at times, there are hints of this, that Sansa is kind of jealous of Arya's freedom. There's a scene in Game of Thrones where Arya's coming in. She's been playing. You know, she's filthy. She hasn't changed her clothes in a couple of days.
Yeah.
And Ned walks into the room and Sansa thinks, oh, Ned will scold her for showing up to the castle looking like this.
Yeah.
And what does Ned do? Pats her on the head, hugs her, and sends her away.
Uh-huh.
And you can see Sansa resentful of that. And there are little hints throughout, right, where you do get the sense that Sansa thinks, why does Arya have this kind of freedom?
Yeah.
And then I am just expected, right, to behave in a certain way. So I think there's tension maybe on both sides. And, you know, I often think of my sister Jill, who's the middle child. Perfect child. I love her dearly. We didn't really have sibling rivalry, uh-huh. like, you know, Sansa and Arya do, but she was just every expectation, right? She, very feminine, very, you know, obedient, just everything that you would want from, you know, your perfect child. And
right.
I was always kind of the more free spirit, and I was the rough and tumble one and kind of the tomboy. I would
you
go
had
to
the
an
wolf's
event.
Blood.
I did, you know, family reunions. Jill would be sitting politely playing, you know, on a blanket with the other kids, and I'd be in the creek just getting filthy from head to toe. So I was kind of the Arya and she was kind of the Sansa. And so I think if you are the youngest child, there is that kind of, well, we've raised the perfect child. Now the third one, we still love her, but we can allow her to kind of be more of the free spirit, right? We're not going to be quite as structured in our, you know, how we bring her up. And I got by with so much more than my older sisters did because I was the baby. And people kind of encouraged me in my recklessness. So I think there's some of that going on too, you know, with these sisters.
I think
birth order had shifted, you know, things might've been different. Mm-hmm. So Sansa's just expected to be the perfect
child.
And
you almost see that with Rickon too. Rickon's allowed to run wild. Right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
There's also a family resemblance issue that's going on between them.
Oh, yeah.
I think that for Ned, and you see that in one of the chapters in the first book where he says, you look like Lyanna.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the wolf's blood and you have the wolf's blood.
Yeah.
And for the very first time, Arya realizes, oh my gosh, I might be pretty because everyone talks about Lyanna as this great beauty.
Yeah.
And I've only ever thought of myself as Arya Horseface.
Horseface.
Right? And
yes,
so
because Sansa's the pretty one,
yes.
right? So she was always kind of
That's
juxtaposed
right.
against Sansa. Yeah. Sansa.
And I think that there's something about Ned that thinks, I see my sister in Arya. So I'm
yes.
going to let whatever rules she breaks, I'm going to forgive. Because that's kind of
yes.
what my sister did. Whereas Sansa is being taught the rules of femininity and, you know, of sort of the social class and whatnot. And she's obeying the rules.
Yes.
And she can't get away with the kinds of stuff that Arya gets away with. And I think that does bring a little bit of resentment.
I think you can see hints of it for sure. You know, you have to really kind of look for it, but I do think it's there. And I think there probably are many times where, you know, Sansa, even if it's not something kind of overtly acknowledged in her own mind, there probably is this kind of jealousy about how maybe I would enjoy just kind of breaking free and running through the woods and just throwing caution to the wind
right.
and doing whatever I want.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I can't do that because I'm Sansa.
Right.
And I'm the one who's supposed to be the future queen and, you know, all of these expectations that people have for
mm-hmm,
me.
Mm-hmm.
So I sympathize, I think, with both of them. I definitely see where they're both coming from because I just compare that to my sisters and me.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Now, she does, we said that, you know, she has to kind of figure out how to navigate this world because she's isolated, right?
Yes.
There are a couple hints, though, that there might be adults in the room who are looking out for her in this chapter.
And I wanted to ask you, Anthony.
Yeah.
What is it about Sansa that makes people genuinely want to help her? And I know Dantos, right? She saves Dantos's life, but the Hound, for example, such an interesting relationship those two develop. And Tyrion is so sympathetic to her. And, you know, Littlefinger, we know he has ulterior motives, but she just draws people to her.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's smart enough to figure out, you know, even in this chapter, she knows Tyrion's being nice to her, but she's developed a cynicism now where maybe before, oh, he's just being nice. Now she's questioning why he's being nice. So she's definitely getting smarter and playing the game. But she also knows that, okay, if he is being nice to me, how can I use that to my advantage?
Huh.
So, you know, what do you think is really drawing, even early on, why are people drawn
to Sansa? Well, if I was going to be totally cynical, people in this world view her as a political asset.
Mm. Even the Hound?
I don't know. Like, I think that there's something about, maybe not the Hound, there's something very primal about attractive people.
Yeah.
Where they get things that other people don't get.
I was thinking that too. Might be the most immediate thing. She's pretty.
Right.
People are drawn to her because she's so attractive. Yeah.
Especially with men, especially men that want to help her. There's something about her looks that's a part of that. I also think that there's something about the fact that she's a political asset. I do think that there's something like, if this war goes well, we are going to wipe out the Starks. We're going to marry Sansa to a Lannister. And this is absolutely going to help us rule the North. Right?
Yeah.
So there's part of that. With the Hound, it's probably different. I think that there might be some attraction there, as gross as that might be. And I think that there's something about her, like, he always, early on, he would always call her a little bird, right?
Yeah.
Keep singing, little bird. They, you know, keep singing all the songs that they taught you to sing. I think that he's smart enough to see that she's now figured out how to survive. And even there's that one point in this chapter where she blurts out, "No, you can't kill him." And Joffrey's like, "Are you telling me the king can't do something the king wants to do?" And she comes up with this idea off the top of her head, which, you know,
very clever.
It's, you know, it's bad luck. It's bad luck on your name day you can't do it today. And immediately the Hound steps in, almost like, you know, like an improv, you know, he's like a yes and to her lie that she's telling.
Yeah.
And says, "Oh yeah, it's known. You can't do that. It's what you sow on your name day, you will reap all year long." I think that he likes the idea that she is playing with him. I think that he likes that there's someone in the room that's a little bit smarter than him, that's going to kind of expose him for being the fool that he is.
Yeah.
I think he likes that about her.
And I think Tyrion comes to like that about her as well. You know, those private looks they give each other, especially after they're married, you know, those inside jokes. But do you think there is also, and I'm still trying to kind of parse through how I feel about this. I keep thinking about, you know, Tyrion's line, you know, "I'm kind of a sucker for cripples, bastards, and broken things." And I think for me, it might be that the Hound and Tyrion, certainly, you know, to an extent, they see her as so vulnerable. And, you know, I keep thinking about that moment where the Hound tells Sansa how he was burned.
Yeah.
And he has never shared that. He has never made himself vulnerable like that. And then, of course, he has to cover up and say, "If you tell anyone, I will kill you." So anytime he's kind of soft with her, he always has to then act, as she would say, despicable. Right. Why are you so despicable?
Yeah,
because he has to maintain that front, right?
Yeah. Why does he get vulnerable with her kind of despite himself?
I think that he knows that she's in a nest of vipers.
Right.
Right. He sees how, even early on, you know, even before Ned is beheaded and she's held captive, But especially after that, you know, do you remember that scene we referred to this where she's beaten for the first time and Joffrey commands her to come to court right after her father dies? And she learns very early on, if I say what I think, I'm going to suffer the penalty for it. I won't survive this way. And it's really the Hound who helps her come to that conclusion by saying, there's nothing you can do. Play the game. Right.
Yeah,
Don't ever speak your mind. Or what does he say to her exactly?
She says, what does he want from me? And he says, he wants you to keep doing what you're doing. He wants you to sing these little songs that you've been singing. He wants you to act like his lady love.
Play along.
Play along.
Yeah. This is how you survive.
That's how you survive.
And she keeps coming back to his words. You know, the Hound said, don't say what you're thinking. You know, play the game. Just be the person he wants you to be. And she even thinks of that in this chapter. Like when she blurts out a couple things, oh, pull back. Because that's how I survive. And so he jumps in then and, you know, helps her do that. And so I don't know. I just keep thinking that maybe he sees, you know, the idea that he hates to see somebody like her abused.
Uh-huh.
Right. Somebody who is so much more helpless, like he was with his brother. And then, of course, Tyrion, you know, obviously knows what it's like to feel helpless and bullied and, you know, to be beaten down.
Well, and
not be able to defend
herself.
She's
not a cripple or a bastard, but she presents
she's
as
a broken thing, right? Yeah, absolutely. And I think that he very much taps into that and sympathizes with that, you know, very early on.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Now, I do want to talk about someone who's not in this chapter, but I think looms over this chapter, and that's Cersei.
Yes.
I noticed in this chapter that everyone in this world is simply assuming that the Lannisters are in power. You have first Aerys Okart, who's basically saying, the comet represents, you know, the king's, it's the king's comet. And she's like, yeah, but if it was the king's comet, shouldn't it be gold?
Mm-hmm.
That's what she's thinking. But of course, he's thinking, oh, it's Lannister red. Isn't that interesting? So it's almost like, again, Robert Baratheon's dead and the true power in this realm is Cersei. And the Cersei's a Lannister, right?
Right.
And then you have Tommen when he's going to tilt against the Quintain. You know, he shouts Casterly Rock, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't shout like Storm's End or King's Landing or something like that. Tommen is absolutely a Lannister, right?
Yes.
Both literally, but also the realm has decided that they're going to lean into the Lannister politic because Robert's gone and there's no pretense anymore of pretending that the Baratheons are in power. Even so much so is that the Quintain is dressed up like it's a leather dummy, you know, stuffed with straw, and Tommen's going to tilt against it.
Yes.
It has the antlers of House Baratheon. So you almost see that everyone is sort of leaning into this. We are now on Lannister turf. And Sansa notices, or she mentions to, I guess she just thinks to herself, Sansa's thinking, is Cersei going to be at the tournament? Because if she's there, I know Joffrey will behave.
Right. And she's dismayed to find out.
Yes. Yeah. Even though she no longer trusts Cersei, because Cersei's a Lannister, she knows that Joffrey will be brought to heel by his mother's presence.
Right.
And I think everyone in this story knows that Cersei is the real power and that Joffrey's kind of the face of the institution.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. I was so struck by all of the, just the overt Lannister symbols and references. It's like everybody's still kind of pretending that it's a Baratheon thing, but everybody knows,
like,
right?
Not even almost, I mean, I think that if they were going to like say, of course, it's, you know, Joffrey Baratheon, we know that he's a Baratheon, but all the symbols and everything that people are saying are really trying to kiss up to the Lannisters.
Yes.
Like even when Tyrion comes to court, and we should talk about Tyrion.
I love Tyrion.
Even when Tyrion comes to court, he says, where's your mother? You know, that's where he's headed. He knows that the mother is where the power is.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, I know that you love Tyrion. Boy, can he make an entrance, right?
Yes. Going back just a second though.
Yeah.
It's in, I don't think it's in this chapter. It's in one of the chapters in the book in A Clash of Kings where, sorry, Anthony, I can't remember whose point of view it is in the book, but discussing how decisions are made in the throne room.
Hmm.
Do you remember this chapter? And
no.
Cersei is really the one who calls the shots, right? And then once in a while, Joffrey, you know, who looks completely bored. I think this is actually in a Game of Thrones where Sansa first comes to court. And, you know, Joffrey's sitting on the throne. He looks completely bored. He doesn't care about what they're discussing or who is coming to speak before him. So Cersei's just making all of the decisions about what will happen. And then Joffrey will kind of perk up and notice that things are happening without him and say, oh, but I'm going to decide the punishment for this person, cut off his hand.
Mm.
So, and they have to kind of give in, right? Because
right.
we have to make Joffrey think he's in charge. And this becomes even more apparent, of course, when Tywin comes in. And, you know, those first couple moments where
right.
Joffrey tries to challenge Tywin, it's very apparent that it's really in lip service only that Joffrey is the king and that it's really Tywin, you know, running the show. But Tyrion, you know, Tyrion serves that role, and he and Cersei throughout
yes.
the rest of this book really jockey for power and control and play the game against each other. and try to get one up on each other. And that relationship is actually one of my favorites in the series.
Yes, it's fantastic. I love, like I said, no one can make an entrance like Tyrion.
Love him.
And it's almost like you see at the end of this chapter a shift in power. Everyone in the chapter is assuming that Cersei has all of the power, right? And then as soon as Tyrion shows up, you can almost feel the thing tilt, right? It's like, oh, interesting. Now we have a new Hand of the King. The question is, who is going to be Tywin's mouthpiece, right?
Yes.
And of course, because Tywin has this view of his sons over and against his daughter.
Yes.
She's enjoyed a little bit of power. And now she's going to have to almost go back to using courtesy as armor like she's done her whole life.
And I love that chapter following this one because it's that first confrontation, right, between Tyrion and Cersei. And that's, I think you're right, Cersei really has to in that moment reckon with the idea of, okay, now Tyrion's here, the game has to be played differently.
Yes.
And the first thing he says to her is, "Father had to send me because clearly you are just messing this up."
That's right.
And, you know, he doesn't make any pretense of that. And then just confronts her with the whole Jaime thing. And it's so well written.
Oh,
and it's
gosh.
So clever how these two go at each other.
I love it whenever Tyrion gets a chance to interact with a member of his family.
I know.
It's so different. He deals with his immediate family so differently. And there's even difference within the family. Like, he'll take a different voice with Jaime than he does with Cersei, than he does with Tywin, than he does with Myrcella, than he does with Joffrey. It's all very authentic. But you don't get to see that voice in Tyrion unless he is working within the interior of his family.
And yes, if we go back to this chapter with Joffrey, right, where he comes in, and I was so struck by, you know, again, Sansa's armor is her courtesy.
Right.
You know, she even repeats that line on my page 37, a couple lines before then, where, you know, Tyrion saunters in, he's got all of his, you know, mm-hmm. motley crew with him. And if her armor is courtesy, his is sarcasm. And Joffrey rarely picks up on either, right?
And I think you're right.
When he, just a few lines here, I just laughed out loud when I read this again, because he tells Sansa, "I'm sorry for your loss." And she knows immediately, was he mocking her?
Mm.
Right? She picks up immediately, is he being sarcastic? Is he not? And then he looks at Joffrey. "I'm sorry for your loss as well, Joffrey." "What loss?" "Your royal father, a large, fierce man with a black beard."
Right.
"You'll recall him if you try."
Yeah.
"He was king before you." And then he goes on to...
Yeah, Joffrey says, "Oh, him." Yeah, well, that was really
sad. He was killed by a boar. And then what does Tyrion say? "Is that what they say, Your Grace?" So Tyrion already has it figured out.
Mm-hmm.
He knows who killed Robert. He knows Joffrey has not figured out any of this, right?
Yeah.
Joffrey is completely excluded from the game. He's just a pawn in that game. So, but he's able to slip in these things and use them to his advantage because Tyrion doesn't have physical strength, although he's a pretty good warrior at times. You forget, you know, he actually does pretty well. But his strength has always been his ability to be clever and say clever things and to know how to play the game and his ability to use humor in the right moments.
That's right.
And say things just overtly to people, but say them in a way kind of like Sansa does, say them in a way where he's got certainly one meaning, but they won't pick up on it. And he does that quite a bit here through this, you know, through this chapter.
Absolutely. I'm just going to read this paragraph. This is him entering. And this is all from Sansa's perspective, right? In their midst, riding a tall red horse, was a strange high saddle that cradled him back in front, was the queen's dwarf brother, Tyrion Lannister, the one they called the Imp. He had let his beard grow to cover his pushed-in face until it was a bristly tangle of yellow and black hair, coarse as wire. Down his back flowed a shadowskin cloak, black fur striped with white. He held the reins in his left hand and carried his right arm in a white silk sling, but otherwise looked as grotesque as Sansa remembered from when he had visited Winterfell. With his bulging brow and mismatched eyes, he was still the ugliest man she had ever chanced to look upon. Every now and again, I don't see Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
And it takes a passage like that for me not to see Dinklage when I'm reading Tyrion.
Yeah.
I've mentioned this on the pod before, but it was a long time ago that I mentioned it, and I'll mention it to you. In the ancient world, there was a practice of pseudoscience called physiognomy, which you probably are very well aware of.
Yeah.
And the idea with physiognomy is that you could tell the either the virtues or vices of a man's soul by how they looked on the surface.
Yeah.
And fundamental to that practice, and there's a lot of writing about this, is the idea that the eyes are the window to the soul. And we even, you know, that phrase survives into the modern world.
Right.
We have notions of, like, does he have beady eyes? Because you can't trust guys with beady eyes and things like that. Tyrion's eyes are absolutely a social disability for him. That would be my argument. Mm-hmm. If the eyes reveal something about your character and you have one green eye and one black eye, those mismatched eyes are going to appear sinister to someone with a more ancient sensibility.
Right.
And it's such a crucial part of how Tyrion has to negotiate the world around him. He looks devious. Right? It doesn't matter what his character actually is. You could tell what's deep down in his soul just by looking at his eyeballs.
Yeah.
And I think Sansa's coming to realize that maybe looks aren't all that they seem, but I don't think she's quite there yet.
I don't think she is either. You know, obviously that's just a really dominant trope, right? Throughout literature and into this day where, you know, one's character is represented by one's outward appearance. Mm. And so if you have something grotesque, right, that is a person to be feared or a person to be hated or a person who is unworthy. And certainly the people in Martin's world adopt that point of view. You know, you and I were just talking about how if you're attractive, that gives you a huge advantage.
Yes.
People tend to equate your attractiveness with your goodness, with wanting to do good things for you. And if you are somebody like Tyrion, right, it's almost like you have a social contagion.
Yes.
Either you're somebody who is sinister or you are somebody who might just by touching you, you remember how many times Cersei just flinches from his touch. It's almost like he'll, you know, give her some disease just by touching her. So there is.
I like that phrase. What'd you say? Social contagion.
Social contagion. Yes. Right.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, again, though, what's so beautiful about Martin is that he takes that trope and just turns it on its head. Yeah. Some of the most grotesque characters are those that we end up sympathizing the most with, right. And not because we feel pity, but because they do such incredible things, right? I'm thinking of that line with Kat when she first meets Brienne. And her first reaction to Brienne is to feel pity. Do you remember she says, there's nothing more pitiful than an unattractive woman. And then look at what Brienne goes on to accomplish, right?
Sure.
The Hound, another great example, right? We've been taught that somebody with a burned face is the villain. And, you know, the Hound, we come to realize, is much more complicated than that. So I love that complication. But I also love the idea that somebody like Tyrion, who does feel, he would never admit this to most people, but does feel very deeply, right, how he has been treated and marginalized simply for how he looks. He carries this with him constantly, you know, especially after, my goodness, the Battle of Blackwater Bay when he loses his nose, which, you know, the show does not portray. He gets the big scar, but, you know, clearly he doesn't lose the nose.
Right.
So it does sting him, you know, every time somebody pulls away from him, or a child cries,
or
when
they call him the imp, right?
Or if they call him the imp,
he does not like that name, right?
Doesn't like it, but how does he weaponizes it again, right? He takes what is supposed to be his greatest weakness and he uses it to empower himself,
right?
And he's able to, I was thinking about this, you know, some of the most successful characters in Game of Thrones are those who typically in any other story you would look at and say, weakness, vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
and they use that for strength. They're able to turn that around and say, actually, this is what allows me to do what I'm doing, or it's the foundation on which I will build strengths. And or those who aren't able to perform, you know, masculinity
mm-hmm.
Or femininity in mm-hmm. ways that are entirely expected. They're able to you know, combine, you know, some of those best traits. So like
yeah.
Tyrion can't fight physically most of the time, but he has these tremendous wits, even though he is embodied in a male, you know, body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sansa, again, people constantly underestimate her because they think she's weak and small and pretty. She won't be a threat. You know, how many times does Cersei call her stupid? Joffrey keeps saying, my mother thinks you're stupid.
Right.
Okay, yeah. Great. Keep thinking I'm stupid. That only works in my favor because you won't see me coming. Everybody is just completely, you know, shocked when they think that Sansa is involved in Joffrey's assassination.
Uh-huh.
We never saw that coming,
uh-huh.
even though, of course, she had nothing to do with it. But I really like, you know, Bran, another great example. You and I have talked about Bran. You know, here is somebody who his entire life he was told, you grow up, you're a man. You go on to do these manly things, whether that's
yeah, he wants
being
to be
the lord
knight,
of a castle
right?
or you're part of the Kingsguard. That
yeah.
was his dream. And he shattered it first when he realizes I can no longer do what I completely expected to be able to do based on my gender and based on my class and, you know, based
yeah.
on these things. But what does he do, right? He takes that and he turns it around and really defies those expectations. So those are some of my favorite characters,
right.
Those who are able to adapt and use their strengths and develop their strengths in other areas. You know, those are really the survivors in this story.
Yes. I feel like with Tyrion in particular, his disability, I mean, I guess I'm calling it a disability. I'm thinking about this, really the social aspects
yes.
of it.
Yes. He's in this world. He is very disabled.
Physiologically, you could debate whether or not he should be thought of as disabled or not. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Socially, he wears it on his face like no one else wears it on his face. Right.
Right. Right.
The Hound wears something else on his face, but it's almost like there's more shame attached to that. For him.
Yeah.
And
bitterness, right?
Yeah.
Just that deep bitterness.
They both have a similar aspect. It's almost like Tyrion's physiological presentation represents his father's shame.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Hound's burnt face is his own shame, because I don't feel like his older brother, who actually did burn him, feels any remorse for that at all. I don't think his older brother cares one bit about his younger brother.
Right.
So I feel like it's an interesting thing to put those two in the same room, and, you know, they clearly don't get along, right?
Yeah.
But they both have to walk around the world with the faces that they've been given, right? They have to come face to face with people wherever they go, and they wear their history on their face.
Yes. And going back to your point about eyes, you know, I was really struck with how Sansa, you know, this again shows how perceptive she is, because as she gets to know the Hound more, right? At first, of course, he terrifies her,
mm-hmm.
right? She looks at his face. Oh, he's burned. He's huge. He's scary. And then the more she interacts with him, she begins to realize, I'm not bothered at all by his face.
Right.
It's what's in his eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
And she says, it's his eyes that scare me, because they are so angry and they are so haunted and
right.
they are so resentful and bitter, right? That, as understandable as that is, given how traumatized he was as a child. And so, you know, the first time she meets Peter Baelish, right? Littlefinger, he's able to fool most people, but she looks at his eyes.
Yeah.
The first time at that first tourney. And she says he was very handsome. He had a very well-groomed appearance, but his eyes. And the very next line is she felt uneasy.
Huh.
And so those eyes, right?
Yeah.
We keep kind of coming back to that, what they reveal about a character,
uh-huh.
their vulnerability, how other people see them, I think is so significant.
And I think what Sansa's, the lesson she absolutely has learned is it doesn't matter what you look like on the surface. You could be a monster underneath, right?
Yes.
She learned that with Joffrey.
Yes.
I don't think that she's learned that the opposite might, the reverse also might be true. It could be that you might look grotesque on the surface, but deep down you might be a good person. I think she might be starting to see that in the Hound. I think that she might be starting to see that in Tyrion, but I don't think she's quite there yet.
Right. She's definitely learning. You know, she says several times, how could I have ever thought Joffrey was handsome? So he looks the same, right? Yeah. But now he appears to her grotesque. This opposite occurs with the Hound, right? What at first appeared to be grotesque is now I'm not afraid of him at all.
Yeah.
Because I'm beginning to learn that underneath this exterior, we have a person who is vulnerable. You know, we have a person who can be kind, who can show mercy.
Right.
It's interesting that the Hound is the only one who doesn't beat her.
Right.
And Joffrey never, I don't think Joffrey even asks him to.
Huh. I wonder why that is.
I was thinking about that. Do you think it's because he knows the Hound would just openly defy him and he doesn't want to lose face?
I don't know. I think that there's something about the Hound that he knows he kind of goes his own way sometimes.
Yeah, because the Hound, too, will say things to Joffrey that nobody else could get by with.
Right.
And it's interesting that he does get by with it.
Sure.
And Sansa's usually the only one who picks up on it. You know, she'll look at him like, wow, I can't believe you just said that.
Right.
And then people just kind of move on. It's quite interesting what he's able to do and say.
That's right.
That other knights certainly would not and could not say. I mean, look at poor Dantos, right?
Right.
He just wants a cup of wine and Joffrey's going to kill him.
I want to mention something I just learned the other day. I was on Aaron's podcast and he told me something about Dantos I never knew before. And maybe you know this already, but...
Is it his backstory?
It's his backstory.
Yeah, with the Mad King.
He seems to... Yes, you're right. He seems to be the last member of a house that has been completely wiped out because Tywin has decided he wants to commit genocide of this entire family.
Right.
And then, of course, Barristan the Bold says, you know, there's this 12-year-old kid. He had nothing to do with it. You have to grant me this boon. Let this boy live.
Right.
His entire line, his family, is all... I mean, you kind of now see, like, this is why this guy's been drinking himself into a stupor. He's tragic, this guy.
Talk about being isolated. You know, at least Sansa knows that there are other family members out there. Her entire line has not been wiped out, despite the fact that, of course, Ned has been executed. She knows that Rob is King of the North. He's fighting. He might liberate her. You know, she knows they're out there. But this poor Dantos, he has no family connection whatsoever. They're gone. And it was, as you said, you know, punishment for the capture of King Aerys.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
Yeah, it's really tragic. And it makes me hope that at some point maybe we'll get, you know, a series just based on that era. I would love to see that as well. So maybe after House of Dragon, they'll move forward a few years and give us the Mad King.
As long as there's still money to be made.
Yeah, exactly.
So notable introductions in this chapter, of course, Dantos we meet for the first time. We meet a number of knights that we have not met before.
Yeah.
I won't name them all, but we also meet Lady Tonda and Lawless for the first time.
Lawless.
Gosh,
poor thing.
Then show differences. In the book, the Hound does not fight in the tournament. And, we get to see Tyrion's famed saddle in this, right? We've heard him talk about it before. We also see Tyrion's, you know, what he actually is supposed to look like with the black and platinum hair.
Yeah.
And the mismatched eyes. And then notable departures. I didn't find any departures in this chapter I guess we could say the departure of Dantos's knighthood, because he's going to become Joffrey's fool, I suppose.
Right. And meets a very tragic end later on.
Really? Absolutely.
It's terrible.
I guess you could say wrong place, wrong time, always with Dantos, right?
But as somebody, certainly, that Littlefinger recognizes early on, he can manipulate and use.
I think the seeds of that are in this chapter. I think that Littlefinger's looking on, thinking, this guy has developed some kind of allegiance with Sansa. Who is Sansa going to trust?
Right.
How can I use that to my advantage?
Right. He will be the conduit, right, through which I can then get Sansa and solidify more of my power. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything else that we missed?
The only other thing I had, we pretty much talked about why Sansa seems to be such a hated character. And I think a lot of it does have to do with she's not displaying womanhood in a way that matches traditional masculinity, right? Those tend to be the characters that we tend to validate more, right? The idea that you can only be a strong female character if you are performing what we associate with stereotypical masculinity.
Oh, you're talking
right?
about from modern, the modern readers.
From a modern, right? Yeah. So those are the characters who I think get more attention. They're the characters who are more popular, right? So when female characters step outside of, you know, what those traditional expectations of their gender, those are the ones we tend to applaud. So that makes me think a lot about just in society in general, how we tend to undervalue or devalue or even stigmatize anything associated with feminine, right? The feminine. But I also was thinking about how just observant, you know, Sansa is. Yeah. We talked about this. She is, you know, you mentioned this, Anthony. She is really the character whose point of view allows us as readers just to see how truly corrupt this world is.
Yeah, she's learning to see below the surface, right?
She's the one who really, I think more than any other character, allows us to see the contrast between what should be, what you're taught in the stories and the songs, and what is actually there. And so kind of as she grows up and learns how to play and learns how to, she is so observant, you know, kind of her chief function, particularly in this book, she gets a lot of point of view chapters, is to allow the reader to see that crumbling, right? The idea that the vast majority of people in this world are really just looking out for themselves. And that's what drives their motives. And there really isn't true chivalry. There really isn't true honor. And those who try to hold on to that, again, are usually the ones who will be snuffed out pretty early on, right? Those who try to do the right thing. Cersei
or
learns
it just
that
is
early
not going
to
look the way that you thought it was going to look, right?
Right. I have to get in the dirt at times, even if you're an honorable character.
Yeah, I think Tyrion does treat her with courtesy.
Yes.
You know, he even
does.
Says to Joffrey, like, I'm sorry for your loss, even though he's not sorry that Robert's dead. I doubt that he's sorry.
Right. Although he does have affection for Robert. Do you remember? He says at one point, I did kind of like Robert. He was a fool, but I'm sorry he's dead.
He absolutely is acting courtly in this chapter, right? We know that there are times when he will not act that way. But it's just not going to look the way you thought it was going to look. It's not, you know, the person that is as handsome as Joffrey, you know, might not be that person, might not be the person out of your storybooks.
And even, you know, if you look at the Tyrells, for example, they're beautiful people, right? They're kind to Sansa. Mm-hmm. And yet she's still kind of being warned, don't trust. Mm-hmm. They might be giving you lemon cakes and telling you everything that you want to hear, but they also have a political purpose. Nobody is kind to you for no reason. So she really does, as sad as that is, you know, as she goes through, just learns not to trust people, to always question. She's doing it to Tyrion at the end of this chapter, even though I think his motives toward her are much more pure than, say, the Tyrells. But even Tyrion, he's being nice, but Cersei was nice to me as well. Joffrey used to be nice to me.
Yeah.
And look how that turned out.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
I mean, the direwolf comes in and bites, what's the ugly kid?
Joffrey?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
You think he's ugly? You think Joffrey's ugly?
Oh, he's repulsive. His face looks like it's both upside down and inside out somehow.
Yeah, and oddly attractive. I don't know why all you're right. calling him ugly.
You and I definitely have different tastes in princes.
I suppose so.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
So, Ian, you're a Scotsman, are you not?
I am indeed, yes.
Okay. Is that an old-timey term, or is that still correct to call men from Scotland Scotsmen?
No, I think that's fine. It's when we start getting referred to as Scotch. I think that's when we start to bristle slightly.
It would have never occurred to me. I want to test your identity as a Scotsman.
Okay.
I just learned just this morning a Scottish idiom, and I'm hoping that you've heard this before.
Okay.
Okay, the Scottish idiom goes like this. Possession is 11 points in the law, and they say that there are but 12. Have you ever heard that before?
I haven't, no.
Okay, all right. Well, I was looking up this idiom that we have in the U.S. called possession is 9/10 of the law.
Yeah.
Meaning that it's much more difficult to claim ownership of something if you don't have it in hand, right?
Yeah.
And then I was told by the internet, which is, of course, never wrong, right, that this is sort of an evolution of old Scottish saying that I just quoted to you.
Hmm.
And I just thought, well, that makes sense to me because, you know, famously Americans don't do fractions very well. we've mistranslated the numbers. So anyway, but I had hoped that maybe you had heard that saying before. But it sounds like maybe it's too old timey even for you, Scottish historian.
I'm obviously not Scottish enough. That must be it.
I've tested your
and I've failed
identity as a Scotsman, and you failed. So we're just gonna call you garden variety British from now on.
Oh no.
I bring this up because it seems like, you know, we're talking about House of the Dragon. It seems like this is exactly Rhaenyra's problem at the end of season one. It feels like she has a good claim to the throne, but possession is kind of the lion's share of the issue, right? It's like she might have the better claim, but geography is against her. She's not in King's Landing. She's not publicly sitting on the Iron Throne. This is a big problem for her.
Yeah, I think that coupled with the fact that she seems to lack an obvious kind of structure around her. I mean, obviously she has Daemon, but beyond that, I mean, she's removed herself from the seat of power.
Well, she's got the court, you know. She's got the court around her, and yeah, all of the wills and bessels. I don't think that's a phrase. whistles and bells, the accoutrement of the court. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I suppose, yeah. I mean, she does have her own court, but I suppose maybe it is due to location. But I just saw that as being the various structures of government, like the small council and things, are all there in King's Landing, and Alicent and Otto have control over that. I think that helps the Greens to seize power. They're in physical position to do it. I think ultimately as well, it comes down to the fact that Rhaenyra is a woman. I think a large portion of Westeros has been itching to have a male successor ever since Viserys named her Azizel.
Right. No, that's certainly the story they're telling. But, you know, if, let's just imagine the roles are reversed and she's at court, she's there to put the father to bed, right? She can put the king into the grave as she sees fit. She can arrange the coronation. I think the idea of her being away from the court is a big problem for her. And maybe clearly the story that they're trying to tell is that her gender is the biggest problem of it. But she might be able to overcome that if she were in the right place at the right time. And I'm wondering if you can think of like elements of medieval history or Scottish history where you've got two claimants and the one who's actually at court has the better claim just because of possession being 9/10 of the law.
I think this, the House of the Dragon generally, I think it's been alluded to by several historians that the obvious comparison is with 12th century England, is with the period of the anarchy, that period that follows the death of Henry I, and the supposed succession of his daughter Matilda, but then the seizure of the throne by Stephen instead. And Stephen kind of does that, doesn't he? I mean, he goes
well,
to England.
Well, maybe let's back up here. Maybe tell us a few particulars of the anarchy that maybe we don't know.
So, I mean, Henry the First has lost his son in the white ship disaster. The ship sinks, and the heir to the English throne
goes with it.
And so he's left then with no sons. And so his daughter then is his next heir, and rather like Viserys, he gathers the English nobility around him and has them swear to recognize Matilda, right, the daughter, as his heir. But of course, as soon as Henry dies, things are a bit different. And in part, it's because Matilda's husband is a bit of a problem. There is an English concern that England will be subjugated by a foreigner and these types of ideas.
Oh, he's a
as
problem
well.
Because he's a Frenchman? Is that right?
Well, I mean, that was the problem before with Matilda when she was married to the Holy Roman Emperor. And then this is our second husband who is French. But yeah, there are still concerns about his actions in Normandy, and yeah, there are concerns about what he would be like, I suppose, alongside her.
I'm vague on these details. What actions have put him in ill repute?
So it's Geoffrey of Anjou, isn't it? And I think he has been throwing his weight around on the continent in regards to those English domains on the continent, and that then worries the English nobility, because it's in that period, isn't it, where the Anglo-Norman dominion is still in place, but England itself is developing something of its own separate identity, and what it doesn't want, and what it has rejected actually in the decades past, is to somehow find itself subjugated to a Norman-led polity, I suppose.
Right. Now, so his chief sin, it seems like, is that he's gained a reputation for being overly ambitious.
Yeah, I think that probably right.
Okay, all right. And so so her husband's a problem, but she's been named queen, right?
Yeah, and again, the nobility have signed up to that. But I think there remains a faction of the English nobility who does want to see a male successor. I think, to be honest, that is often the case. I mean, we have to remember that medieval kingdoms and medieval nobles, you know, are an interesting ecosystem. And half the time they don't even want children succeeding, because these can be times of quite serious upheaval. The perfect situation is that an adult male succeeds to the throne,
yeah,
because they have the ability to take control, keep things as they should be.
Yeah, it's a better chance of peace, a peaceful transition, right?
Yeah, and kind of benefit. So even in the case of a young male monarch coming to fruition in a succession, there is unease, I think, within the nobility, and I think that's ratcheted up when it's potentially a female succession, because it's not like there has been a long history of those in the past.
Right. Now, is Matilda in France when Henry the First dies?
Yeah, she's on the continent, yeah.
Okay, so this is kind of what I'm talking about. Like, because she's out of the country, or beyond the water, whatever we want to call it, her gender's not just against her, it's geography.
Yes, and I think that's where Stephen kind of steals a march. He, you know, you get that notion of him rushing to England to capture the throne for himself.
Right.
But I don't think that would have been possible if he didn't also have support for his succession. If the English nobility had held firm and said, no, we've sworn to recognize Matilda as queen, then surely Stephen couldn't have been successful. It would have been a busted flush. He's only successful if there is the support for him to actually do that, to take that action.
How did you like the show? I'm assuming you're completely through the first season, right?
Yes, I managed to cover it.
How did you like it? You know, you're a professional historian. You're also kind of interested in how the medieval period is represented in you know, modern storytelling. I'm kind of curious just to hear your general impressions.
I mean, I really enjoyed it, actually. I read various reviews, which I thought were quite harsh, that were complaining about it being kind of slow. But I thought it was good to see different themes and different things being discussed.
Yeah, me too.
That portrayal that's based very much on politics, it's based around the court, Succession, you know, and I think that's very different from what Game of Thrones became, which was all about, you know, war. It was a kingdom at war, and of course this is probably going to go that way too. but this
shows the fault lines. I mean, I guess the first book and the first season,
yeah,
it does a lot to show the fault lines that are really like 13 years old or something like that. But this really makes a meal out of the fault lines. The whole first season is about every episode you hear that crack, just a little bit of a crack, sometimes a bigger crack than the others, but you'd really get the sense that these people have a history with each other, the two main folks, Rhaenyra and Alicent, you know, going back to childhood. So that the stakes of the war, it feels to me, it's not just about the political aspirations of the characters. It's the emotional investments that they have in each other and that we have in them. And I'm really enjoying that part of it.
I agree, absolutely. And you don't have that investment in the characters unless you are given the opportunity to invest in them. Right. I don't know. It's affected by the time jumps. but still, you can see, as you say, that the relationships that have developed then, you know, breaking apart or mm-hmm. changing, and the fact that a lot of this happens within the extended family as well, you know, just makes it even more interesting in terms of how that all develops. Yeah, and I have rather enjoyed it.